Good evening and welcome to another Miliband lecture. We are this evening part of a series of Miliband lectures on the state and market this academic year. And it's a particular pleasure for me, for academic and personal reasons, to introduce Stephen. Let me say something briefly about Stephen Lukes's background, and then I'll say why it's a particular pleasure for me to introduce him. Stephen Lukes is, of course, known to us at the LSE only too well, not only obviously because of his books, but because he was here between 2000 and 2003 as a visiting centennial professor. He is currently professor of sociology at New York University. He took, if I take him back to your PhD, he took his PhD in a very eventful year, 1968, on the work of Emil Durkheim, and of course subsequently wrote the definitive study of Durkheim, and in my view it remains the definitive work. From 1966 to 1988, quite a long stretch, he was fellow and tutor in politics at Balliol College, Oxford, and made an extraordinary rich contribution to the study of politics and political theory there. He is a fellow of the British Academy and has been a visiting professor at an extraordinary array of universities: University of Paris, University of New York, University of California at San Diego, and the University of Jerusalem. He is a man of many interests, academic as well as others, but I'll just list some of his academic interests. He's worked, of course, first and foremost in political and social theory, but within that he's worked on the sociology of Durkheim and his followers. He's worked on individualism and rationality. He's worked on Marxism and ethics, new forms and varieties of liberalism, varieties and conceptions of power, the notion of the good society, the debates on rationality and relativism, among other topics. His publications are many, but I think they're distinguished by having set the terms of discussion for a very long time. If I go backwards, really, in time, his, as I already mentioned, his book on Durkheim, his life and work, which is an extraordinary volume and certainly influenced me greatly as a student in the 1970s. His book on individualism, which was an absolutely decisive contribution at the time, published in 1972. Then came in 1974, a very, very small book. We should all take your example, actually. Write very, very, very small books that have very, very big influence. And his book, Power, Radical View, I think was some 20,000 words. I've always been trying to persuade publishers, even me, Polity Press, my publishing company, to accept a manuscript of mine of 20,000 words. It's very rarely done. But here was a short book that made an absolutely decisive contribution to the debate about power, the development of political science, and political theory of power. Then came Essays in Social Theory, Rationality and Relativism, Durkheim in the Law, Marxism, Morality, Power, and more recently, Moral Conflict and Politics and Multicultural Questions. Then on top of that, of course, he's written other things, numerous essays and so on. But in 1995, he wrote a novel published by Verso, The Curious Enlightenment of Professor Caratat, as well. Now, on a more personal note, I would like to add that I came of intellectual age, as it were, if I ever have, in the 1970s, under the influence of two remarkable figures. If you were a student in the UK in the 1970s in sociology and politics, you couldn't have helped but come across the publications, the interests, the buzz around, someone in Cambridge and someone in Oxford. It just so happened that I was located in Cambridge, and the person in Cambridge was Anthony Giddens, and the person in Oxford was Stephen. Being a student, as I say, in the UK at that time, you couldn't help but come across both, and in my case, be inspired by both. For me, then, it's a particular pleasure to welcome Stephen here this evening, someone whose very, very bright light has shed light on my own work and my own path since the 1970s. He'll speak this evening in the Miliband series on markets and states, on a title absolutely spot on, if only all speakers could be persuaded to be so relevant and precise: Pathologies of the State and the Market. So please join me in giving him a very, very warm welcome.
Thank you so much, David. Actually, perhaps my title should be very slightly different: Pathologies of Markets and states. So let me begin with full disclosure. I had a great admiration for Ralph Miliband and also a strong feeling of affection. I rejoice in remembering him and on this occasion in commemorating him. He was a tough, resilient intellectual of the left. And, I nearly said, but also, a warm and lovable human being. Further disclosures are that Marion has been a good and exceptionally kind friend to me and my family. And David, who sadly is not here, did politics tutorials with me at Oxford, though with this disclosure comes a disclaimer of responsibility. And one memory. I recall various dinner parties in the Miliband household after Ralph's untimely death. His spirit presided while David's political career prospered. I used to say that this was the most interesting dinner table in London. I also owe a debt to both David and Edward. Long ago, I promised to write a book entitled What is Left? A title which I claim to have invented. No other people have used it. David repeatedly asked me when it was coming out. And Edward discussed its theme with his students at Harvard and wrote to me about it. Well, I never wrote this book, which is hard to understand since as the years have gone by, it would have been a shorter and shorter book. So I think of this lecture as part payment of that debt. Now, in it, I want to ask, when markets do harm, what distinctive harms do they do? And similarly, when states do harm, what distinctive harms do they do? And in asking these questions, I'm not interested in market or state failure. But is all well here?
I'm just going to put this closer.
Ah, can I not be heard?
Not so well in the back.
Oh, okay.
Is that all right?
Can you hear me in the back? Okay. So in the lecture, I want to ask, when markets do harm, what distinctive harms do they do? And similarly, when states do harm, what distinctive harms do they do? In asking these questions, I'm not interested in market or state failure, but in the harms which, when they occur, are consequent upon their success. That is, I won't be concerned with what economists call market failure and political scientists call weak or failed states, but rather with what harms can be attributed to markets and states when they function as their advocates recommend, when they function well in the ways that they're supposed to function. So I'm going to have little to say, something but not much, about the well-known virtues of market exchange and state planning, but focus instead on the evils or undesirable or unacceptable consequences that have been held to result from the successful functionings of these twin and often contrasted modes of coordination and allocation. Quite often, these are not only contrasted, but they're not only contrasted, but they're seen as alternatives. The strongest version of this thought is that they're to be seen as mutually exclusive and even jointly exhaustive, such modes. Fundamentalists on either side of the debate claim that the one is the solution to the problems they attribute to the other. In recent times, market fundamentalists have been in the ascendant, advocating the encroachment of the market in successive and hitherto market-free spheres of social activity. In previous times, advocates of state planning sought severely to restrict, even eventually to abolish, market exchange. Those less extreme advocate various forms of mixed economy, differently configured combinations of market exchange and state planning. Well, I'm going to conclude this lecture by questioning two assumptions very commonly made, that the defects of each are genuinely distinctive of markets and states, respectively, and secondly, consequently, that each is best thought of as always the appropriate remedy for the defects of the other. First, some definitional ground clearing. Of course, there are many different kinds of markets, but for shorthand, I shall refer to the market to mean what the Pope of neoclassical economics, Professor Samuelson, says it means, namely, a process by which the buyers and sellers of a good contract to determine its price and quantity. It's the process of trading through enforceable contracts, which, unlike gift giving, the giving is conditional upon payment in return. In markets, the operating rule is quid pro quo. And following Max Weber, I shall take the state to mean the human community that successfully claims the monopoly of the legitimate use of physical force within a given territory. And I'll add the need for a legitimating constitution, whether formal or informal, and a minimum range of legitimated and functioning institutions. Market failure occurs when reality fails to live up to theoretical requirements. Real markets fail because they're imperfect. They fail to exhibit the idealized conditions under which they would otherwise succeed. When economists apply their theory to real-world markets, it soon becomes evident that the typical causes of market failure, negative externalities, asymmetrical information, natural monopolies, monopoly power in general, non-zero transaction costs, economies of scale, outright coercion, and social norms incompatible with efficiency, are widely prevalent. Now, one response on the part of pro-market economists is to present the reality of imperfect competition as coming close to the ideal of allocative efficiency and all-round welfare maximization, sometimes with greater and sometimes with lesser plausibility. Another response, ever more significant at the present time, is for market actors and policymakers to transform that reality by marketizing it, by converting some areas of social life that are insufficiently marketized into markets or pseudo-markets. Marketization, I shall take to mean reconfiguring goods and services so that they can be priced and sold, inducing people to want to buy them and redirecting the motivation of workers who produce or provide them from collective aims and a service ethic to profit-seeking and market discipline. Well, that's about market failure. Now, as for state failure, this results from inadequate institutional capacity. Typically, this is the problem of industrializing states, the problem of inadequate fiscal capacity needed for funding development projects, and of inadequate capacity to coordinate the investment strategies of firms to monitor their performance and ensure their compliance, and to acquire, process, and apply the information required to perform these functions. The prerequisites for avoiding such failure are a rational, well-oiled bureaucracy, a central coordinating agency with real authority, and a high degree of embeddedness in the economy with dense ties to the industrial sector. These are the problems of industrializing states, but we need to consider state failure in advanced industrialized states. There, the problem is not inadequate but inhibited state capacity that results from the implementation of currently prevalent beliefs that the state, whether in practice or in principle, lacks the capacity for planning the economy and other areas of social life, and that the market should replace it, or simply those from the business world, who, of course, always know and do better than state bureaucrats, according to this view. Now, according to these beliefs. So much for state and market failure. Now, let me now turn to the market and the question, what harms do markets do? The virtues of the market system have been proclaimed for at least three centuries, beginning with the French and Scottish Enlightenment thinkers. The French deemed it socially beneficent, writing of Le Doux Commerce. According to Montesquieu, whenever manners are gentle, there is commerce, and whenever there's commerce, manners are gentle. Condorcet, my favorite thinker, wrote of the spirit of commerce and industry, those enemies of the violence and turmoil which cause wealth to flee. And Voltaire praised the London Stock Exchange as a place where, quote, you will see representatives of all the nations assembled there for the profit of mankind. There the Jew, the Mohammedan, and the Christian deal with one another as if they were of the same religion, and reserve the name of infidel for those who go bankrupt. As for the Scots, Adam Smith praised David Hume for showing in his History of England, quote, how commerce and manufactures gradually introduced order and good government, and with them the liberty and security of individuals who had before lived almost in a continual state of war with their neighbours and of servile dependency upon their superiors. And it was, of course, Smith who developed the classical economic defence of the market. The market system accounted for the wealth of nations, maximizing allocative efficiency through mutual adjustment, rendering incentives compatible and, as once multiply, enabling sustained growth and development. In general, I suggest, we can say that the case for the market's beneficence as it stands today is partly economic and partly social and political. On the one hand, markets coordinate economic activity by communicating through prices information unavailable through any other mechanism, and provide incentives for people to train themselves and to innovate. In consequence, markets exhibit dynamism, the capacity for innovation and long-term growth. And markets are, under ideal conditions, which, as we've seen, as I've suggested, normally don't exist, they are Pareto efficient, that is, leading to an equilibrium in which no one can be better off over time without someone else becoming worse off. On the other hand, again ideally, they secure liberty, enabling autonomous preference formation on the basis of adequate knowledge and voluntary exchange, expressing consent and cooperation in the face of divergent values. And they promote certain kinds of equality, enabling unforeseen relations between strangers and dissolving hierarchies with a formal right of exit. So, having said all of that, what harms then do markets do? Here we need to go back to the 19th century and the heritage of German Romanticism. Deploring what he called the brutish God-forgetting profit and loss philosophy, Thomas Carlyle protested that, quote, cash payment is not the sole nexus of man with man. And 5 years later, in 1847, Marx and Engels took up this very phrase in the Communist Manifesto, writing that as the constantly expanding market spreads over the surface of the globe, pitilessly tearing asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, that the market has left, quote, no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest and callous cash payment, the very words of Carlyle. Men are drowned in the icy waters of egotistical calculation. Now, neo-Marxists developed this theme, such as Lukács, writing of commodity fetishism and reification, and the Frankfurt School wrote of the colonization of the life world. But critiques of the market extend across the left-right spectrum, and indeed beyond it. Policy-oriented social democrats like Richard Titmuss, and cooperative socialists like Marcel Mauss, speak of the market driving out altruism and reciprocity. Communitarians speak of the morality of the bazaar, that's Michael Waltz's phrase. And Republicans write of the erosion of public institutions and the corrosion of civic virtues. Feminists see the market in gestational surrogacy as degrading to women, and they argue about whether prostitution oppresses and entraps women or expresses their economic freedom. Tradition-minded right-wingers resent the way in which markets disrupt hierarchies, and anti-immigration movements oppose labor markets. And beyond the left-right spectrum, supporters of green politics defend protecting the environment against the anthropocentric view embodied in markets of well-being as maximizing through markets merely human preference satisfaction. Well, I suggest, just to try to generate some analytical order into this, that there are basically three plausible ways of viewing markets as harmful. And also want to say that suggest that the first of these, which I'm not going to talk about now, that the first of these on inspection mostly dissolves into the second and the third. The first is summed up by a term which is fairly widely used, but especially by those influenced by Marxism, the term being commodification, a highly normative notion. As generally used, to commodify something or someone is to treat as a commodity what should not be so treated. So let's look more closely at what this can mean. Margaret Radin, in her book Contested Commodities, has most helpfully dissected the notion of commodification into four component processes. Goods or services are, she suggests, commodified when they exhibit the following features. First, objectification, that is, treating persons and things instrumentally as manipulable at will. Secondly, fungibility, that is, when they are fully interchangeable with no effect on their value to the holder. Thirdly, commensurability, that is, when their values can be arrayed as a function of one continuous variable or can be linearly ranked commensurably on a single measure, single metric. And fourthly, the idea of money equivalence, namely that metric is monetary, that is, where the continuous variable in terms of which they can be ranked is monetary value. Now, when all of these features are present, commodification is fully at work. So, that leads me to ask a question which actually is not normally asked. What's wrong with that? What's harm? What harm is held to flow from these characteristics? Well, I think the answer is twofold. First, that certain goods and services are said to be debased or distorted by being commodified, that is, treated as marketable. Call this the corruption argument. And by corruption, I mean to adduce the idea of pathology, which I put in my title. That is, the thought that the impact of the market is to impair or degrade otherwise well-functioning and potentially flourishing activities and relationships. So, for example, in his book, Everything for Sale, which more or less tells you what the contents are, Robert Kuttner writes that, I quote, a few quotations, the advertiser dominance debases journalism into entertainment. He writes that religious and then secular holidays have been, quote, debased into three-day shopping weekends. And he writes that making free libraries more market-like would destroy their essence. So you get the idea. Secondly, that's the corruption argument, but secondly, the corruption can spread once the process begins in respect of one such good. Others are infected, and so the contamination spreads across persons and across goods. Call this the contamination argument. So, going back to a famous LSE figure, Richard Titmuss, and by the way, LSE figures are going to figure in this lecture surprisingly often. Richard Titmuss argues for both corruption and contamination in his book about the gift exchange. About blood, about the giving of blood. And he argued, when he wrote that book, that he claimed that selling blood crowds out altruism, diminishing the scope for giving it and also other worthwhile things in society. As he famously put it, private market systems in the United States and other countries deprive men of their freedom to choose to give or not to give. The commercialization of blood has the effect of discouraging and downgrading the voluntary principle, he wrote. Both the sense of community and the expression of altruism are being silenced. This was his central claim. And Margaret Radin, whom I referred to before, speculates that full and open commodification of sexual services, advertised, for instance, as she speculates, in the way that automobiles are, would, quote, be reflected in everyone's discourse about sex, and in particular about women's sexuality. And with this would come a change in everyone's experience, because experience is discourse dependent. She wrote that book several years ago as though this was a speculation about the future, but I suppose we might ask to what extent that hadn't actually happened, at least the advertising. But the question is, do the consequences flow? Now, to some ears, these examples I've just given of the corruption and contamination arguments, to some ears, and maybe many ears here, there's more than a hint of paternalism, primness, prissiness, cultural elitism, or even communitarian nostalgia about arguments like this. So here's a more robust argument, which comes from a more robust claim, and this comes from the economist William Baumol, and his idea that there are services, I quote, in which the human touch is crucial and are thus resistant to labor productivity growth. They resist, he thinks, standardization because treatment must be tailored to the individual case, and quality is, or is at least believed to be, inescapably correlated with the amount of human labor devoted to their production. And so to commodify in these various ways that you commodify is to damage them, is to neglect and override this feature. Well, Baumol's original examples were the performing arts, but he then extended this to other services such as teaching, doctoring, and policing. But Colin Lees has argued, I think convincingly, that, I quote, Baumol underestimated the constant resourcefulness that capital displays in its efforts to resolve the problems it confronts, including its ability to wean consumers from the services onto consuming material goods and providing the labor component themselves, and finally consigning any small residue to high-end markets or leaving them to increasingly beleaguered state provision. I'm thinking there especially of health services. Now, medical services. The question I want to ask at this point is, what's objectionable here? What is it? In Britain, the commodification of medical services has involved the splitting up of different services, not all of which are Baumol-like in resisting productivity increases, while enlisting patients in the provision of the service. And we could say, couldn't we, that this is not obviously a bad idea. On the other hand, you could say that the growing consumption of drugs and painkillers, the speeding up of the examination of patients, and the very fragmentation of services, especially in hospitals, points in the other direction. More generally, the very idea of care, as in healthcare and childcare, implies uninhibited responsiveness and flexibility. And that's precisely what's threatened by the demand for efficiency and contractual arrangements. But note that these features, if the demand for efficiency and contractual arrangements, are not unique to the market, but both profit-driven markets and taxpayer-driven bureaucracies impose these managerial constraints on caregiving. And I'm going to come back to that point. The central thought behind the corruption and contagion arguments is that certain goods and services are too morally important to be bought and sold. Michael Sandel, who we could label, if he has to have a label, a kind of civic Republican, he writes that in the cases of surrogacy, baby selling, and sperm selling, the ideals at stake are bound up with the meaning of motherhood, fatherhood, and the nurturing of children. The philosopher Elizabeth Anderson suggests that market allocation is only suitable for what she calls pure economic goods that are merely means to other individual ends and are traded with equanimity for any other commodity at some price. And so she thinks it's inappropriate for goods that are what she calls higher, personal, or shared. The market, in other words, is inappropriate for goods like that and services like that. So recalling Radin's component elements of commodification, we deny or neglect the meaning of such goods, on this view, by treating them as objects, as exchangeable, as commensurable, and as having prices. But I ask, is this convincing? Is Titmus right that selling blood crowds out altruism? Or was Kenneth Arrow right in criticizing Titmus for failing to provide either a theoretical analysis of why it should be so, or any real evidence that it does? Is Margaret Radin right that commodifying sex changes everyone's experience? Or is Anne Lucas right that, I quote, both reasoning and evidence suggest that commodified and non-commodified sexuality coexist without diminishing human flourishing? Indeed, this diversity and coexistence may actually enhance flourishing in other areas of life. Don't people, I ask, endlessly contain contradictions and exhibit ambivalence? Is it really true that treating others as means to individual ends and seeing the world in impersonal and quantifiable terms are incompatible with altruism, reciprocity, and the realization of values that are, in Elizabeth Anderson's terms, higher, personal, and shared? Mary Douglas has persuasively argued that goods are to be seen as ritual adjuncts, and that their consumption can be seen as a ritual activity which uses goods to make firm and visible a particular set of judgments in the fluid process of classifying persons and events. That's in her book on the world of goods. Here's a question. Are there not many contexts in which instrumental relationships and seeing the world in anonymous and commensurable terms is actually much to be valued? Indeed, as an essential precondition for and counterpoint to mutual relationships in more intimate settings. Moreover, this very opposition between the market and intimate settings can be questioned. As Williams and Zelitzer argue, many market transactions have elements of emotion and sociability, and many intimate transactions have economic dimensions. Is it even obvious that treating people as objects and as a means to some end is always a bad idea? Remember that Kant's famous categorical imperative enjoins us to treat persons never simply as means. That's the phrase. Not don't treat people as means, but don't treat them only as a means. Surely it must depend on the end and on who is doing what in pursuing it. According to his biographer, Beethoven was filled with, I quote, filled with a deep conviction as to the significance of his work and his art. And in 1801, he referred to two of his friends as, I quote, merely instruments on which to play when I feel inclined. I value them merely for what they do for me. As for commensurability and pricing, why assume that we cannot both know the price of something and know that it's priceless? I believe we do this all the time. We adhere to the Christian and Kantian idea that the individual is sacred, while we make insurance decisions and pay medical administrators and planners to allocate resources and plan the siting of roads and airports on the basis that all the options involve the statistical certainty of a certain number of deaths and injuries that we actually expect to be costed on a rational and systematic basis that puts a regularly updated and commercially based value on human lives. Marketizing and marketizing goods and services do, in some cases, I have no doubt, distort and debase their nature. For instance, in the contracting out of hospital services, from nursing to cleaning. And the harm that's then done may be amplified through contagion throughout the healthcare system and beyond. But I believe that when we think of markets as harmful, we mainly have other concerns, either of two further concerns, major concerns in mind, and that much of the animus against corruption and contagion actually is about them. So the first of these further concerns is with inequality. Markets reproduce and they amplify inequalities of class, gender, and race. How many people, I ask, would sell their kidneys? And how many women would sell their reproductive capacity under conditions of greater equality of condition? And here's a question. Is the case against prostitution parallel? Is the primary objection commodification or inequality? The inequality worry is essentially the thought that in real-world markets, sellers are pressured into selling and buyers are unable to afford the good things of life, leading in the extreme to what Michael Walzer calls desperate exchanges. In the transnational market for organs, kidneys sell for $10,000 to $15,000 in Egypt and for $1,500 in India, where a cornea fetches $4,000. And in the baby market, black babies cost less than white babies. The general point here is that markets reproduce pre-existing unequal distributions of assets, capital assets and the rights to these, and, on the other hand, personal assets such as brain and brawn and education across individuals, classes, regions, and countries. They also generate inequalities of income. That is to say, markets both reproduce inequalities, but they also generate inequalities of income and status, just because markets as such entail insecurity and risk. Charles Lindblom writes, in a very nice little book called The Market System, he writes, employed today, one may lose one's job tomorrow. Shortly then lose one's savings, home, and even status in the community. Business fluctuations, recession and depression, evict people from their jobs and cut off their claims to income from their labor. Illness and temporary disability put a stop to one's market claims, and old age often promises a termination to all market claims. Now, neoliberals put their faith in private ownership of all assets, unfettered markets, and minimal redistribution through taxation. Their goal is efficiency, not equality, and at best, relieving extreme poverty, relying on market mechanisms to alleviate this and negative externalities such as pollution. That's neoliberals. Socialists have sought both to equalize the pre-existing inequalities of assets and property rights and to provide social security and redistribution through the welfare system and taxation. Social democrats, as distinct from socialists, have focused exclusively on the latter, on the redistribution and on the provision of social security and redistribution through the welfare system. And so social democrats leave the ownership of capital private and very unequal. In Scandinavia and elsewhere, they have achieved dramatic successes which survive. One big question is whether this success requires citizen homogeneity as its precondition. Which leads me to the other major way in which markets are harmful. I mean, I've been talking about inequality. Now I want to turn to the other major way, which is, I think, what people are mainly concerned about when they talk about commodification. I think that the second thing that they mainly are concerned with is that when markets are unchecked, they undermine the bases of citizenship. T.H. Marshall's, another LSE figure, T.H. Marshall's story of the cumulative development of citizens' rights from civic through political to social rights culminated in the stabilization of a significant range of these social rights in various European welfare regimes after the Second World War. The universal provision of education to ever higher levels, of health care, financial support in cases of unemployment, injury, ill health, and old age, and in some very fortunate places, housing, legal aid, citizens' advice, access to public spaces, public libraries, and so on. Now, these can all be seen as supplying the preconditions, all these last things, the preconditions for core citizenship, by enabling citizens to acquire and maintain the capacities needed for its equal exercise. In these ways, the market's reach was resisted by an ethos, whether based on social democratic or, in some cases, Christian ideals, of welfare, publicly funded and publicly provided. But in the 1970s, the mid-20th century citizenship package started to unravel as capitalist firms have resorted to the service sector in pursuit of profit. And with the worldwide spread of neoliberal ideology, abetted by governments of the centre-left in pursuit of economic efficiency, health services, education, public utilities, transport and broadcasting have all been opened up to marketization and privatization. So, what harms can be attributed to these invasions by the market of the domain of citizenship? Well, I think two are worth stressing here. One is the severing of the link between representative, national or local, between the representatives, whether at the national or local level, and citizens and electors. And the citizens and electors become customers and consumers. Marketization and public-private partnerships enable politicians to divest themselves of responsibility and, crucially, of accountability for the provision of public services. The government contracts with the supplier, but citizens can no longer hold their representatives accountable for service delivery, which is rendered faceless by being consigned to the anonymous forces of the market. The other harm, that's one harm, the other harm concerns not merely the preconditions of citizenship, but those of good citizenship, namely the services that generate and sustain people's capacity to function as good citizens. Now, there's no reason to think that these will be provided by market forces alone, or indeed, in some cases at all, to a sufficient extent, or an adequate breadth and depth. In particular, when markets invade the spheres of educational provision, which is a rather topical subject right now, and public broadcasting, no less topical, some of the capacities, notably the cognitive capacity to process information and achieve a rational understanding of one's world, are, to say the least, not encouraged. Public broadcasting is a crucial and endangered area here. And the point goes far beyond what I quoted before, Robert Kuttner's point that advertising debases journalism into mere entertainment. Well, okay. But the point is that, as United States experience abundantly shows, where public broadcasting is only marginally present in a predominantly commercial environment, there are no countervailing mechanisms to resist the descent into trivialization and fragmentation. Or at least those mechanisms are very weak. That is why the glorious BBC, forgive this emotional moment, is the citadel to be defended to the last against market forces, and not just for the sake of British citizens. And I'll say more about this later if you want me to in the discussion. I just compare the state of radio in the United States and Britain. It's a subject on which I feel deeply. Moreover, in a market environment, truthfulness is not at a premium. If consumers don't value truth very much, market competition will tend to ensure that they don't get very much of it as compared with other goods that they do value. In general, market dominance means subservience to corporate media power, and as we've seen in the context of the Iraq War, to the dictates in America, to the dictates of the White House and the Pentagon. So now I turn to states. That's all about the harms that markets do. Now, what about the harms that states do? Well, states are the source, of course, of citizenship, at least as things stand, and the natural framework of the public sphere. But they are also collective actors. So when states act, what harms do they do? The best known answer to this constitutes one of the pillars of neoliberal ideology and is of Austrian provenance. It says, "Beware the state as an agency of central planning, above all when it's in pursuit of social justice." The arguments for this view of the interventionist states maleficence was formulated by von Mises and developed by Hayek. The Hayek version, which achieved fame in his book The Road to Serfdom, was formulated in the 1930s in answer to Beveridge's and Mannheim's argument that fascism is a natural outgrowth of capitalism and that only through planning could totalitarianism of the left or the right be avoided. So you see, this whole business was quite an LSE affair. In 1939, Hayek asked, "Is it a mere accident that the continuous expansion of the powers of the state, which they had welcomed as an for example, Beveridge and Mannheim, is it a mere accident that the continuous expansion of the power of the state, which they had welcomed as an instrument to bring about greater social justice, has in so many countries brought the disappearance of all personal freedom and the end of all justice?" Well, Hayek obviously thought it was no accident. A state engaged in central planning and redistribution was necessarily, he thought, the enemy of freedom and justice. Hayek's key, and I would say his best argument, was epistemic, and it amounted to an impossibility theorem. For Hayek, the fundamental economic problem was, I'm quoting now, "the fact that the knowledge of the circumstances of which we must make use never exists in concentrated or integrated form, but solely as the dispersed bits of incomplete and frequently contradictory knowledge which all the separate individuals possess." It is rather a problem of how to secure the best use of the resources known to any of the members of society for ends whose relative importance only those individuals know. Or, to put it briefly, it's a problem of the utilization of knowledge. So the argument is against the very possibility of social engineering, as Hayek famously called it. Neither, writes Hayek, the available resources nor the existing needs are objective facts in the sense of those with which the engineer deals in his limited field. They can never be known in all relevant detail to a single planning body. Unquote. So a central authority on this Hayek argument can only rely on statistical aggregates, which, as Hayek wrote, are always arrived at by a deliberate disregard of the peculiar circumstances of time and place. And so Hayek concluded that a successful solution can only be based on, quote, a method of utilizing the knowledge dispersed among all members of society, knowledge of which, in any particular instance, the central authority will know neither who possesses it nor whether it exists at all. And this can only be done, he thought, through some mechanism, I quote, which will delegate the particular decisions to those who possess it, the knowledge, and for that purpose supply them with such information about the general situation as will enable them to make the best use of the particular circumstances of which only they know. And that mechanism, not surprisingly, is, Hayek thought, the market. Now, from this argument, Hayek drew, which I think... Plainly, is an argument of considerable power. Hayek drew wildly extravagant conclusions, employing what Albert Hirschman has called the rhetoric of reaction. Start central planning and redistributing income in pursuit of the mirage, of, as he calls it, of social justice anywhere, and you are on the slippery slope to full-scale disaster, imposing one group's values on all and breaking the fetters of democratic procedure. Moreover, whatever you do will be massively counterproductive, it will also be futile, and it will also, in the name of advancing equality, destroy your citizens' liberty. Hayek assumed that the competitive market is the natural spontaneous order of human society. He had nothing to say about the realities of monopolistic and oligopolistic markets and of massive corporate power. And yet Hayek, who after all won the socialist calculation debate, was right about the indispensability of market signals for the relaying of inherently dispersed and local knowledge, and he was right about the limits that this knowledge, embodied in local practices, sets to projects of state-led social engineering. Now, this last theme, the limits set to state-led social engineering, has been graphically portrayed in a remarkable book by James Scott called Seeing Like a State, which explores the ways in which modern state-led projects of social engineering extinguish practical knowledge that is local, dispersed, and relatively autonomous. In fact, Scott scarcely refers to Hayek in his book, and his inspiration is anarchist and not market liberal. But his conclusions are very similar. Unlike Hayek, he doesn't offer an impossibility thesis, but rather compelling case studies of successful state enterprises that are human disasters. The designing, planning, and building of Brasilia, Soviet collectivization, and compulsory villagization in Tanzania. Three extreme instances of massive state-imposed social engineering. His claim is that these exemplify what he calls high modernist faith, found among those, I'm quoting, who wanted to use state power to bring about huge utopian changes in people's work habits, living patterns, moral conduct, and worldview. A faith typical of the avant-garde among engineers, planners, technocrats, high-level administrators, architects, and visionaries. Their projects prevail under certain conditions when, I'm quoting, the legibility of a society provides the capacity for large-scale social engineering. High modernist ideology provides the desire, the authoritarian state provides the determination to act on that desire, and an incapacitated civil society provides the leveled social terrain on which to build. Well, Scott's three cases illustrate that, I'm quoting him now, the necessarily thin, schematic model of social organization and production animating the planning They illustrate that the necessarily thin schematic model of social organization and production animating the planning was inadequate as a set of instructions for creating a successful social order. By themselves, the simplified rules can never generate a functioning community, the central claim. By themselves, this can't be done. Formal order, to be more explicit, is always and to some considerable degree parasitic on informal processes which the formal scheme doesn't recognize, without which it couldn't exist, and which it alone cannot create or maintain. So Scott thinks of these processes, these informal local practices — Scott, by the way, is an anthropologist — he calls these practical knowledge, a wide array of practical skills, as he puts it, and acquired intelligence in responding to a constantly changing natural and human environment, local, situated knowledge, which contrasts with the central state's necessarily crude general understandings. So Scott attributes three distinct but relate. So the question then is, this is what I'm driving towards and have asked, what harm? Okay, what's the harm involved here? What is the damage? Well, Scott attributes three distinct but related harms to the state's lack of local practical knowledge, or its neglect of it, its ignoring of it. First, it leads to mistaken policies, ranging from blunders to catastrophic errors, mistaken calculations of demand, misallocation of resources and people, suboptimal or counterproductive policy choices, failures to perceive and seize opportunities, and so on. Well, all of this was central to the Austrians' concerns, and of course was fully illustrated in the record of economic policies under actually existing socialism. Second, it leads to bureaucratic rigidity, unresponsive to local conditions and the particular needs of individuals and groups, to inflexible laws and rules, suppressing diversity and exhibiting the logic of uniformity and regimentation. So Scott sides with Jane Jacobs against Le Corbusier and with Alexandra Kollontai against Lenin. Scott's book juxtaposes, it's a very amusing and enjoyable book because it also has illustrations which juxtapose homely-looking higgledy-piggledy townscapes and quaint old maps with lonely inhuman streets and squares and austere geometric plans. And thirdly, the third harm is that the state-led engineering systematically distorts people's lives by imposing technocratic dreams upon them, irrespective of their own dreams and values. As Scott puts it, his case is that, quote, certain kinds of states, driven by utopian plans and an authoritarian disregard for the values, desires, and objections of their subjects, are indeed a moral threat to human well-being. So like Hayek, Scott exaggerates, and he focuses on extreme worst-case scenarios of state planning. Yes, Brasilia, but what about St. Petersburg and Haussmann's Paris? What about the New Deal? What about Scandinavian social democracy? What about the United States interstate highway system? Public health successes, such as the eradication of yellow fever, cholera, and polio, and so on. Yet, Scott does suggest, and certainly his title suggests, the title of the book, Seeing Like a State, that all states are disposed to seeing like a state, and thereby threaten the indicated harms to human well-being. So now I come to my conclusions, which are basically two. I want to conclude with two observations about the respective pathologies of the market and the state. Now first, the harms that each has been held to cause are, I claim, not distinctive of either. So market actors can certainly see like a state, and states can commodify and behave or seek to behave like market actors. Corporations employ ever more sophisticated ways of rendering their markets and potential markets legible and of monitoring their own operations. And they certainly exhibit what Scott, talking about the state, calls the logic of uniformity and regimentation. Here are two examples. In its relentless pursuit of low prices, Walmart has become — I'm quoting from a very interesting new book, recent book on Walmart — Walmart has become arguably the world's most important privately controlled economic institution. Its scale, which is now goes far beyond the United States, allows it to constantly and quickly extend the area it controls deeper into the factories and offices and decisions of the chain of companies that feed it, across new lines of business and across wider and wider geographies. Walmart is increasingly in control of its own ecosystem. Moreover, it, quote, keeps track of the number of items per hour each of its checkout scans, clerks scans at every cash register, at every store in every state, for every shift as a means of measuring their productivity. And it measures sales by running foot of shelf space for every item and category to make sure that stores and individual products are productive and to compare their productivity. As it swallows up competing retailers and dragoons its suppliers, its impact on local practices and knowledge, and the knowledge that they embody, is notorious. Its arrival in small towns, I'm quoting from this work, coincides with a swath of destruction of local retail businesses, and while its parking lots swallow up the landscape. Here's a second example. Giant pharmaceutical companies are increasingly adept at monitoring and in turn influencing the prescribing practices of doctors. And in both cases, demand is investigated, monitored, and shaped on a global scale and in ever greater depth. And as these two examples show, the seeing like a state is intimately bound up with the commodification, with instrumental relationships, not least in Walmart's management practices, and with measurement and with pricing. Conversely, since Max Weber, it's surely not news that such practices, typical of bureaucracies, are characteristic of the way that states behave, and all the more so these days under the pressures of auditing and cost-cutting in the context of globalized market conditions. I feel that I hardly need remind an English academic audience of the ways this works, for example, in the assessment of teaching and research in public educational institutions funded by the state. And it is curious that in the real academic market in the United States, the commodification, at least the obsession with quantitative measurement of productivity and rewarding it with money, is significantly less developed, though it's on the way. Moreover, states are more and more behaving as market actors, as partners of market actors, and are seeking to simulate real markets in the absence of private ownership and even private provision, as when public authorities seek to allocate collectively owned resources by market pricing. As Colin Crouch suggests, these should perhaps be better described not as markets, but as cases of oligopolistic providers making deals with monopsonist customers. What bearing, do states have on the other harms? What bearing do states have on the other harms I referred to as consequent upon markets, the reproduction and aggravation of inequalities and the undermining of citizenship? Well, obviously states can contribute to these harms by favoring markets and by partnering or simulating market actors. But now we can ask another question. To what extent is it feasible through state policies to reduce these harms? Consider first inequalities of assets, whether property and property rights, or inequalities of marketable skills. And consider, and alternatively, inequalities of income and other benefits that accrue to individuals. More specifically, to what extent is this feasible, the equalization of these, in the case of competitively democratic states? And I'm assuming that it's states, and these states in particular, that are for the foreseeable future the only plausible agents of such equalization as compared with local, regional, or supranational bodies. Well, clearly, the socialist policy of asset equalization, of equalizing property rights and marketable skills, is the less feasible. Here, doubtless, as an equalizing educational policy is the most promising in respect of personal assets. But as for the latter, the social democratic policy of equalizing flows of income and other benefits through fiscal redistribution and social insurance, The welfare states of Northern Europe, especially the five Nordic countries, have demonstrated remarkable successes. And I quote here a sentence of John Romer, that despite the predictions of some conservatives that the welfare state is dying, that is not the case. The welfare states of these countries are changing at the edges, largely because of changing demographies and immigration, but they are not disappearing. But herein lies the other harm that we've been considering, namely the undermining of citizenship rights. For if, as I suggested before, the successes of those social democratic welfare states has relied upon the precondition of citizen homogeneity, then they may not be generalizable, these Scandinavian, these North European cases, generalizable or indeed sustainable in the longer term. For it is the market, in this case the international labor market, which enables and encourages these changing demographies and immigration, and it is an open question to what extent states can or should limit immigration in the interests of preserving citizens' rights. And I may say that, fortunately, since this lecture is almost at an end, I can't enter into that subject now. Finally, my second and concluding observation is simply a worry about the very topic, and forgive me, David, about the very topic of this series of lectures, states and markets. Perhaps we should question the bipolar disorder that leads us to think in an either-or way about these. In this lecture, I've focused on the harms attributable to markets and to states. I suggested the ways in which markets commodify, aggravate inequality, and undermine citizenship rights. And I've suggested the ways that states disregard and extinguish local knowledge. I further suggested that these harms are perpetrated by both states and markets. And finally, I indicated that markets, as repositories and distributors of knowledge, are indispensable to states, and that states, as agents of social insurance, social services, and redistribution, are an indispensable corrective to markets. And so, I suggest, we may conclude, neither is the panacea for the ills of the other. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for a vintage performance. We have time for questions. In the old theatre, where we usually have the Miliband lectures, I take them in clusters of four or five, but because this is a smaller theatre and a sort of more intimate space, I think it'd be more appropriate just to take them one at a time so we can develop perhaps more of a dialogue. Mm. If anyone else wants to go, may I just suggest that they do so now, or sit still till 8 o'clock. So let's create a space for those who want to exit. See, otherwise it comes in drips and drabs. Amazing. 7:30 is a key time at the LSE. Dinner is in various places ends soon, you see. So you have to have a great deal of sympathy for those who are leaving. So whilst that exit is occurring, let's stay. Yes, Robert. They're roaming mics that'll come around.
An absolutely tremendous lecture, very enjoyable and sort of thought-provoking. It is very wide in its ambition, and I suppose my question is simply relating to that. What seems to me to be a lacuna, and there could be others, and maybe you're not worried about them because you gave us a tremendously good account of the things that you did concentrate on. But one could say that one of the problems with commodification is its link with patterns of consumption and the, as it were, model or metaphor of consumption as the human relationship to the natural world, and that this also involves large-scale waste. Societies that produce lots of goods also produce huge amounts of rubbish, and one could say that this is poisoning the planet. I mean, it's too banal, it's an obvious enough point, but it could be that markets certainly bear responsibility, a very large one in this area, that states bear some responsibility, perhaps a very large one, but that maybe there's at least states might be more part of the solution than part of the problem. Though there'd still be the Hayekian problem of information, I readily see that. It's just that markets aren't out there to identify those sort of problems, whereas perhaps totally remodeled states or institutions of civil society could be. So it's the problem of a big social bad there that markets seem to produce.
Hmm. Yeah, do we just respond
yes.
every time?
Yeah, let's, I think so. It's a big question.
It's a big question, yes. And is this working?
Yeah.
Robin, that's great, but I agree. I didn't talk about that. The markets as generating an abundance of waste, but you link that. I mean, you in a way, there are two points you're making together there, at least. I mean, there's the idea that markets produce lots of, as you put it, rubbish. And that this has ecological consequences. In other words, you're relating the rubbish to the effects on the environment. And actually, those are two different points, aren't they? Because the rubbish might also just, by saying that, you might just be meaning worthless stuff. But then you say the worthless stuff is harmfully worthless in the sense that it has this pollution of the environment. Well, yes, I mean, I think that, I mean, that borders, of course, on the worry I mentioned in the course of the lecture about the sort of elitist character of this commodification argument, or this kind of commodification argument. I mean, who's to say what's rubbish? Well, I'm sure you and I agree about that. But as for the ecological aspect of the waste that markets produce, and your suggestion that maybe states are better at that or can solve it, yes. Though, well, just looking at the 20th century, the worst, some of the worst pollution was actually in state-led societies, wasn't it? Socialist. So actually existing socialism was the disastrous polluter. Sorry, am I not being heard?
You're being very clear, but not into the mic.
Sorry. Well, that's crucial.
Yeah.
So, did you hear me, Robin? So, I don't know. You're right, of course. That was an aspect of commodification I didn't discuss.
May I ask something, actually, on the basis of what you suggested? Georges Kouragan's view, and I think he was the only economist who has pointed that out, that actually the way we look at commodification or so-called suffice itself in a production of commodities by means of commodities is wrong, including Marxist or even market one, because what we call the value added, the final output, is actually somebody's input. And he said actually, and that's why we are getting all these ecological issues wrong in either society.
Mm-hmm.
Because the real output of any system is the waste, which can't be reused anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's the final output.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that, incorporate that as an internalize that, then you can start thinking of ecological issues.
Mm.
Are you not aware of that?
I'm not, and I'm glad to hear about it. But I'm not sure how to respond. I mean, except just to repeat what I said to Robin. I mean, waste. I think we need an analysis of what waste is. Do we mean by waste? Do you mean by waste? Something can't be used anymore.
Yeah,
I see.
That's the real waste. Something you can't recycle or do anything. It's not anything somebody else's input.
Okay.
What is your output, basically? That's the real
waste. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yes.
Question over there.
Professor, I was very interested in your talk, and I couldn't help but think, you mentioned the LSC thinkers, and your talk reminded me of another LSC personality, namely Michael Oakeshott.
Ah, right.
In that,
yes.
Oakeshott, one of his concerns, of course, was the the power and of the state and what was wrong with state planning. But I note he was also concerned about anything that was big, corporations included, intruding into the private life of the individual. And why I thought it might be relevant is because OSHOP doesn't use the emotive issues that get us onto these things so much as what you... I mean, it's good that you use them, but what I like about OSHOP, he brings in the more social context of it, and I wondered what you think of OSHOP's writings in relation to the... To your discussion.
That's so interesting. I'm glad you raised this question. I don't want to sort of hold up the discussion on it, but absolutely, I think, well, first of all, what do I think about Oakeshott? I think that Oakeshott was one of the few genuinely original political thinkers of the 20th century. I think he was profoundly interesting. And this idea of local situated practices, I'd love to know, maybe some people here know, whether Oakeshott and Hayek interacted over this issue. Because there's a definite, there are several thinkers who had this idea of the practical knowledge, local knowledge, which gets damaged by being regimented and ignored from a standpoint outside it. And I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Polanyi on tacit knowledge. And the other thing, as a brief comment about Oakeshott, I think that in some ways, I remember once reading an article about Oakeshott which suggested that he was some sort of, not so much a conservative as an anarchist. There's a kind of anarchic streak there. And it's interesting that Scott's inspiration is also anarchist. So anyway, those are just reactions to what you said.
There are several people who want to ask questions. So can I take a cluster?
Sure, yes. I'll try not to answer too lengthily.
Because there are, a number of interesting observations on the way.
Mm. Can you clarify, or do you make a fundamental distinction between something like Walmart as an element of corporate power and this the sort of signaling mechanism which can transmit local knowledge about prices, the market, on the other hand? Because, I'd love to hear somebody clarify, this... issue. I mean, you tell the distinction between the market as a price-setting mechanism on the one side, and then Walmart as a corporate entity. Is there some fundamental distinction to be drawn between these two, from one direction, very different kinds of institutional practice, or do you see it all as a continuum? Is all part of the same thing, reducible to the market?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Good question. We'll take two or three, and then Paul.
Thank you, Steve. My questions might well relate to what's just been said. I mean, one of the things I'm concerned with is this talk about local knowledge that Hayek uses, that you've mentioned Oakeshott also uses. Knowledge of what? I mean, is it just price-fixing mechanisms? So Hayek is sort of ambiguous about this, whether or not there is something out there that states are unable to capture adequately. There are certain true beliefs about how best to live a human life or organize a state or do certain kinds of things. Mm. But you can also read him as a skeptic, which I think Oakeshott is, that there ain't no answer there. And the trouble with states is they find an answer to a question when there isn't really a question. Mm. So one point is about, what are we talking about when we talk about this knowledge? And the other thing is, who's being harmed in all this? You've talked about the harms that markets cause and the harms that states cause and so on. Mm. I suppose this relates to the first question. Mm. Who's being harmed? Are they assignable individuals? Are they groups? Are we talking about something bigger that touches ecosystems, the life of the planet? I mean, do we need to draw distinctions here?
Yes,
we're talking about future generations?
Yeah.
We do. Yes, gentleman in the middle.
I'm just interested in the sort of commodification side that you were talking about earlier on, and you didn't really touch upon it, but I'm interested in the issue of social cohesion.
Social?
Cohesion, and the impact the market has on social cohesion, and also the impact that then has on issues of law and order. And I wonder if this is the sort of unsolvable dilemma, really, between the market and the state. The contradiction in the sort of new right philosophy of trying to marry classical liberalism and some sort of conservative view of an organic society. And can that ever actually be bridged, or are we going to end up with the state actually acting almost like a policeman to protect those who have in their ghettos against those who have not?
I'm going to take two more, just so that we... Oh, yeah, three more. So can you manage a list of six?
Yeah,
don't go on, yeah.
American broadcasting was not destroyed by the market, but it was destroyed, which it has been destroyed, for public purposes, by the removal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1996. That's to say, the state or the state's agents, as it were, have a role in defining what things compete for and how the market operates. So what destroyed American broadcasting was not the market, but it was a deliberate intervention by the state to remove something from the way in which a market worked, which raises, I think, a significant problem.
Okay. Oh, I don't, yeah. Good.
Fine question, Stephen.
Could you also comment on the concept of state being a market where politicians compete for votes, and Schumpeter's idea of politicians responding, if you like, to market pressures, and what impact that has on the dichotomy between the market and the state?
Mm-hmm. One more, Stephen, finally, over there. Yes, wow. Hillary. Wow. They're queuing up, which is a good sign, a wonderful sign.
We'll just maybe this question tempts you a bit beyond the polarity of state and market, but it's really to ask you whether you didn't really talk about, when you talked about the state, you didn't really talk about democracy, and I wonder whether one can imagine or look at examples of forms of democracy which influence ways of seeing by the state. In other words, whether there are forms of democracy which, to some degree, not adequately, but at least go towards socializing practical knowledge and involve social practical knowledge in the state's ways of seeing.
Since six questions is really already too many, I'm going to take a seventh over there. Oh. No, yes, one more, right. and then we'll slow.
I can't think of a state that's not run by men, and I can't think of markets that are not dominated by men. Are we looking in the wrong direction here? Are we missing something?
Well, that was...
Sorry, I only heard the first half of that. What was the last bit?
Do you want to just repeat the actual question? Go on.
Just whether we're actually missing something here.
Oh, okay. Yes.
All right, Stephen. Well, that's an agenda. And you have... right, you have 7 minutes. So, a minute a question.
Well, okay. This is one reason why no disrespect, but this is one reason why grouping questions is always a problem, because you really want to have a debate with each of them.
I know, but here's the advantage. Yeah. The audience often likes to hear what's on its own mind, as it were. And people in the audience often get frustration when they think they're responding to something and they're isolated in that response. And yet, an array of questions sends out signals, important information.
Well, enough of the meta discussion then. First of all, the point about Walmart, that is something I tried to think about. But what's the difference, that the first question I asked, between the Walmart's response to its customers and the market as it is supposed to operate? Well, there's this wonderful new book I do recommend called The Walmart Effect, which is about this. And the key point is that Walmart has captured, I mean, it's not just that it's a growing monopoly, but it's captured increasingly the command of its own ecosystem. I quoted that. In other words, its domination of its own market consists in drawing all, not only in dominating other retailers, but in drawing through a relentless policy of price cutting, of promising to be lower than every other price, suppliers into its own scheme. So it's kind of monopoly magnified to an extent that we rarely see. But I don't know if that's a telegraphic attempt to answer your question. Also, the techniques. I mean, the means of monitoring that Walmart is now able to muster by virtue of using information technology is unprecedented. The local knowledge question, which Paul raised, knowledge of what? This is terrifically interesting, and I think that of course, well. You ask knowledge of what and whose knowledge, and then you ask who's being harmed. And of course, as for that second question, that of course means okay, we've got to do more work here, because clearly there are different answers to that question. And certainly, if we're going to be talking about citizenship, we're going to be talking about public goods and not just about harm to individuals. Taken severally. But on the question of the knowledge, I mean, if it just you mentioned Hayek and we mentioned Oakeshott. I mean, for Hayek, certainly it's both individual values that are being. I don't think that, unlike Oakeshott, I don't think that Hayek was a moral skeptic at all. But he certainly thought that what happens with the social engineering process is that a particular elite or a particular group of people impose their values on other people's choice or knowledge, if you like, of how they want to live. But it's also, crucially for Hayek, also what people want. I mean, what things do they want? That's to say, what goods do they want to buy? So obviously there are different answers to the question, knowledge of what. And so, yes, it should be. One should be more analytical about that. Yeah. The question about social cohesion, law and order. Yes. Well, you see, if we weren't doing this collectively, I would have asked you to give examples. You say that with the growth of markets, the state becomes increasingly a policeman. And you talked about neoliberal ideology. Of course, according to neoliberal ideology, traditionally the state isn't the policeman; it's a night watchman, isn't it? I think that, and that does, it would be good to know more about what you had in mind here, but I mean, it does perhaps relate to one of the points I raised in the lecture, which was this issue of the market's impinging on citizenship, or the tension that arises when you try to develop an advanced welfare state in the context of cultural and other kinds of diversity that threaten the continuation of that. That's a whole argument which I didn't pursue, but perhaps that relates to what you had in mind. Now, the next question had to do with... What was the next question? Was it Jean's question, the next one, maybe? Yes, I think it was, about the state, about in America. Yes, well, now you say this poses a problem for my argument, and I deeply want to know how. You say there was a deliberate intervention by the state which made the difference in the 90s in America. And I obviously want to know much more about that, but all I can say, maybe my response is over-colored by the fact that I've just come from America. Where I have to painfully endure when I watch television what I can find, and endure the process of trying to find something worth watching, but also the radio. The public service radio is such a pale reflection of what the BBC demonstrates to be possible. I know I'm here preaching to the converted, but it does seem to me this has a lot to do with, it must be, the market environment. And well, at this point, I'll, rather than continuing to argue, I'll just say anecdotally, I came to Britain on Saturday morning, I switched on the radio late at night, and what did I hear? A wonderful program about Pinocchio. And earlier today I switched on the radio, maybe it was yesterday, it was this morning, this wonderful program about Don Quixote. You just don't hear. Of course, I'm here exhibiting all my cultural elitism. I'm sorry, but there we go. The dominance of commercial pressures is just
everywhere apparent, including, of course, in public radio, who are endlessly pleading, I mean, for funds, for funds from subscribers. And, of course, they use commercial practices to try to keep afloat. And broadcast whenever they can, the BBC, by the way, which they pay for, of course. State as a market, in which politicians compete for votes. Well, I'm sorry, I think this is... actually, your question exhibits market thinking, it seems to me. I don't mean to be rude, but this is, of course, an analogy. I mean, just like when people talk about the marketplace of ideas, that's not a market. It's using the metaphor or the analogy of the market to talk about something else. And so politicians aren't market actors. They compete. And we use the market, and of course, in rational choice theory or in game theory, and so I mean, in public choice types of argument, market analogies are taken very seriously. But I think this is not only, in other words, I think when we talk about the political market, we are using an imperfect and largely misleading analogy. This is my brief answer to that. And Hillary's point, my goodness, yes, this is the big question which, in a way, my last remarks sort of open up, which is, I mean, if this is a bipolar disorder, and we shouldn't be thinking this either or way, obviously there is some third alternative, or at any rate, oh God, that sounds like the third way, forgive me, I didn't mean to say that. But there has to be, you know, there are other processes, and above all, you talk about democratic and civil society kinds of processes and mechanisms which are, of course, decommodifying, and which, if I can still use that term, which I should be talking about. But that's, as it were, the next thing to talk about. This whole lecture is, in a way, I see it anyway, a sort of ground-clearing thing. And what you're talking about is, of course, what's really interesting. And what was the last one?
Have you missed something? That the world
no.
Is?
Have I missed something out? Certainly. Okay. But it was to do with... it was a question about women. Well, yes. I don't know, what am I to say about this? I mean, it used to be the case that at any given political meeting, someone would say, well, what about the workers? But I suppose my only response to say is, well, okay, does a feminist perspective lead you to disagree with anything I've said, is what I'd ask.
A question not to be answered now. Thank you very much. But before we go further, two quick announcements and a thank you. The announcement one is that the next Miliband lecture will be Pascal Lamy, who's coming here to talk about the current global trade round. He'll be speaking at 3:00 on the 31st of March in this theater. It's not an ideal theater for him. It'll be extremely popular, so I suspect you might have to come on the 30th. If you want a seat, but it's ticketed, so you need to apply through the events office online if you wish to hear Pascal Lamy on the 31st. The second brief announcement is those who are joining Stephen for dinner afterwards might want to stay here if you don't know where you're going to go next. And finally, I think, thank you, Stephen, for the usual extraordinary quality, for raising a lot of questions, and thank you the audience for raising more, so that we certainly have an agenda, if not a final treatise. Thank you very much. Thanks.